to sing this song for the healing of the world.
Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. I am so pleased to welcome Brad Wolf as my guest today for Spirit in Action. Brad has just released the book, A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, Philip Berrigan, powerfully capturing the life and ministry of Phil in Phil's own words, his witness in the struggle for racial justice against the Vietnam War and all wars, and against nuclear arms through the Plowshares movement. Brad is himself a deeply committed activist as co-founder of the Peace Action Network of Lancaster, and he recently coordinated the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. You can well imagine that we'll have riches to talk about, so remember to listen to the full uncut interview with Brad on the NordenspiritRadio.org website. Right now, we head to Lancaster, Pennsylvania via Zoom to visit with Brad Wolf. Brad, thank you so very much for joining me today for Spirit in Action.
Hello, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Obviously, with the book, A Ministry of Risk, coming out, you're very busy promoting it and sharing that life and story and work of Philip Berrigan. But for you personally, are there still reverberations of the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal? Has that wrapped up, or is there still more going on with that for you?
That is still continuing. We expect to wrap that People's Tribunal up at the end of May. That's been a two-year process that Kathy Kelly and Nick Modern and myself coordinated, and we started releasing the video evidence last November 2023. Every week since, we've been releasing a new edition of evidence where we've charged United States weapons manufacturers with crimes against humanity and war crimes, and we expect to have closing arguments at the end of May. Our judges will deliberate on the evidence and render a verdict. And it's been a great experience, a great project, a good way to communicate a lot of information within the context of a pseudo-legal proceeding.
This is a people's tribunal as opposed to some international court or official government U.S. court. What is a people's tribunal, and do you have some precedent for it? And whose footsteps are you walking in when you do this?
That's a great question, because we are walking in the steps of others. Bertrand Russell in the 1960s had a people's tribunal where he charged the American government with crimes against humanity in Vietnam. And in 2005, there was the World Tribunal in Iraq. In 2020, there was the People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism. There's been other people's tribunals across the globe. And they are not legal proceedings, but it's when you try an actor in the court of public opinion. It occurs when the courts or the government refuse to act and hold accountable individuals or corporations for crimes. Essentially, the courts have been captured by the criminals. And so the people respond. The citizenry steps up and says, if you're not going to act and hold these individuals accountable, then we will. We'll gather evidence. We'll interview people. We will air our complaints before an independent body of judges, and we will render a verdict and hold you accountable. And it's a very effective means of protest and education and communication. And I think it has tremendous power. It's really a democratization of the courts. It's putting the courts in the hands of the people, not for vindictive purposes or vigilante purposes, but for educational purposes and accountability purposes. And so again, we went after weapons manufacturers because we think profit drives war. That these weapons manufacturers are not just passive players responding to contracts from the Pentagon, but that they purposely create a narrative in the media and in think tanks and academia that promotes war, that makes it seem as if the military option is the only option. And they do that for money.
A tribunal, essentially a court proceeding, has a special meaning for you because you were actually a prosecutor along the way. I have a feeling that somehow seeing the world from the people's point of view as opposed to what you do in court is a very different perspective. Tell me about your experience with the law system.
Yeah, I was, as you say, a prosecutor. I'm a retired attorney, and immediately out of law school, I went to the district attorney's office. something I very much wanted to do. And I saw at that time, I believed at that time, that I was on the side of the people. I wanted to work with victims of violence, individuals whose lives had been dramatically altered by violence. And so I became a prosecutor. But after I was there a few years, I realized that I wasn't engaging in public service. I was just sending people to jail. They were just files, endless files to me that had to be worked through. And I was losing sight of the fact that there were lives in the balance on both sides, the victims and the defendants. And so I became disillusioned and I left the district attorney's office and I left the practice of law altogether. I went into academia and began to teach courses in law and courses in literature because I had a master's in literature. So that perspective of being a prosecutor and that experience of being in the courtroom stayed with me. And when the tribunal idea came up, I thought, well, this is an interesting way to use that experience and to still work with the victims of war in a much larger canvas and try to have a tribunal where we're holding accountable truly guilty actors for massive war crimes across the globe. So when we were preparing subpoenas to deliver to these weapons manufacturers, I was able to rely on my memory and my experience as a prosecutor to write these subpoenas. We have other attorneys working with us on a tribunal. So we all work together to write subpoenas and citations, and we serve them on the four defendants down in the Arlington area, the Washington, D.C. area. And by the way, those four defendants are Boeing, Lockheed Martin, General Atomics, the drone maker, and Raytheon Technologies. So we picked those four as being representative of the entire U.S. war industry. Those are our defendants, and those are the ones that we are putting on trial right now.
One of the things I find interesting is your transition from having been a prosecutor to being a peace activist, that in some ways that parallels Philip Berrigan's transition from a soldier in World War II to being a priest to being a peace activist. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. One of the most fascinating aspects of researching Phil's life was reading about this evolution of Phil over the decades. And when I wrote the book, when I edited all of Phil's writings, I put them together chronologically so that they would tell the story of Phil's life, of his evolution, and of what I saw as Phil's upward trajectory toward becoming more fully human over the years. So as you say, he was a World War II soldier, fought in Europe. He willingly went, anxiously went, referred to himself as Philip the Bold, wanted to go and kill as many Nazis as he could. And then when he was there, what he saw and what he did caused him to, as he wrote, look into the mirror of his own violence. And then when he came home, he reflected on that, was deeply disturbed about what the United States had done in World War II, both with the atomic bombings, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also the firebombings throughout Europe. And disturbed at what he had done. So he joined the Josephite orders of the Catholic Church. That is an order that's specifically designed to serve the African-American community. And he chose that order because he was appalled at the racism he saw in his basic training down south during World War II and the racism he saw in the armed forces during his service. So he joins the Josephite order. He becomes a Catholic priest. And in the 1950s, he's a civil rights activist. He's constantly speaking out for civil rights and for the poor and organizing for the poor. And the church is constantly trying to silence him and move him around to stop him from upsetting so many people. And then the 1960s open and the Vietnam War starts to heat up. And then his actions become directed all toward the Vietnam War and resisting the war.
So he went in the Josephite order, but I believe that his brother Dan Berrigan, which order was he in?
He was in the Jesuits.
Which is why he wrote so many more books than Philip did. I mean, Daniel's kind of the famous pen, maybe, of the two. Did they do different amounts of speaking? Because I think that Philip Berrigan was much in demand to voice the angst, particularly the Vietnam War, and then later on with the plowshares movements. Often his eloquent words were important. Was Daniel as much of a spoken presence as Philip was?
As you said, Daniel was the writer. He was a very gifted poet. He won awards, national awards in the 1950s for his poetry and went on to write many, many books. Philip wrote a number of books as well. Philip was in demand as a speaker because he was much more outspoken in civil rights and in the anti-war effort than Dan was in the early years. And it was Philip who had to prompt Dan to take more risks to go against the war. Dan was at Cornell University, and he was, according to his own statements, leading a very comfortable life in academia, counseling students who might be conscientious objectors against the war. But he was not doing what Philip was doing. He was not risking arrest. He was not directly challenging the authorities or the church in the same way that Philip was. It took Phil's insistence for Dan to do that. And once they joined together in 1968 in Catonsville to do that Catonsville action that we can talk about later, then Dan became very outspoken against the war. And they were both constantly out there in public arenas addressing the war and challenging Americans to stand up and do something.
I find that interesting because what I read in Philip's writing, Phil said that it was Dan's insistence, invitation that got him headed towards holy orders. But then it's Phil's actions that get Dan towards the outward activism.
It's such a wonderful relationship the two of them had. Just this sort of symbiotic relationship where one, as you say, you know, Phil was very much in awe of Dan when he joined the Jesuits and thought, what a wonderful thing Dan has done here. What a man he has become as this Jesuit priest. And that was a huge influence on Phil. But then Phil was a huge influence on Dan in later years for Phil's boldness, his willingness to take such a risk of his own freedom, his own liberty to go to prison in order to save others and to stand with the victims.
Folks, today for Spirit in Action, we're talking about the book, A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence. The writings are those of Philip Berrigan, but it's edited with introduction by Brad Wolf. So we have Brad Wolf here with us today. You'll find Brad, we have a couple links on the NordenspiritRadio.org site, one for philipberrigan.com, that'll connect you with the book, and merchantsofdeath.org, which we were talking about earlier. He's Director of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and we'll have a link to their Facebook page on NordenspiritRadio.org. We've got over 200 pages of the writings of Phil Berrigan in this book. One of the things I found interesting was how little autobiographical stuff is included in Phil's writings. He doesn't make it about himself. I feel like theology was his number one love, and I don't mean that in a distancing way. It's a very practical theology. We've got to do peace, right? It's not about talking about these ideas, but he often spoke about the ideas rather than, well, on Thursday I was mad at my brother. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. And again, that was another interesting part when I was doing the research. You know, I'm in the archives. There's hundreds of boxes of papers on the Berrigans. And I'm going through all of these documents at Cornell and DePaul. Their journals, their things that Phil wrote on the back of hymnals, their typed speeches, their articles, their manuscripts for books, everything you can imagine. But in his prison journals, I found it so fascinating that he would have sort of daily entries. And most of us who keep a diary, it's about us, right? Like I did this today or I felt this today. And there was very little of that with Phil. So many of his prison diary entries were about his observations of others in the prison, other inmates, very sympathetic and understanding of their situation and being able to relate the wars abroad with the prison system at home and understanding the connection between that, between racism, between consumerism and materialism, and between war. So as you say, he would reflect on theology. He read the Gospels every day of his life, not just skimming it for 5 minutes, but an hour, 2 hours of reading the Gospel. And then he would write entries in his diaries where he would find these new insights for something he must have read hundreds and hundreds of times before, but yet still gaining new insights from the Gospels. He would say something like, well, reading John today, and it really blew me away when this happened or this, you know, this was said. And it's just really fascinating to read that kind of theological insights. And as you say, it was not theological in the abstract or theological in an academic sense. It was theological in a very personal sense. The question that Phil constantly asked himself is, what does Christ ask of me? He was constantly saying, what is Christ calling me to do? And that's a very personal, very active, very haunting kind of question, but one that Phil lived his adult life by.
One thing you'll note is not included in his writings is a kind of a typical evangelical Christian point of view now. What's important is I believe in Christ, therefore I am saved. It's very clear that Phil Berrigan was talking about salvation as a human experience of people being cared for, living up to God, and then seeing the love of God manifested amongst us. That's very different than that, I got mine, Jack.
Very much so. It's very incarnational in the sense that it's meant to be active in this world. And rather than a church and a church doctrine of prohibitions of don't do this and don't do that, Bill was constantly saying, why isn't the church telling us what we must do today, how we must act today? And so he was embracing a Catholic understanding that went back to the early Christian church, was really living it out in a day-to-day sense. It wasn't something to be held in the abstract. As Martin Sheen said at Phil's funeral, Bill took the gospel personally.
And I have a feeling that you do too, Brad. You're a lifelong Catholic. I grew up Catholic. And when I was 18, I went looking around to find something that suited me better, that matched my theology, my experience better. But I actually have very positive experience of growing up Catholic. I found that theology of the Catholic Church, and it's not just theology, it's the behavior of the Catholic Church, was often disappointing. And I think that that happened for Phil along the way, but that never led him to move away from the church. The church moved away from him, perhaps, because he wasn't as obedient as someone in orders is supposed to be. One of the vows that you take, sometimes is vows of chastity, vows of obedience is one of them. At first, both he and Dan dealt with the fact that they were ordered not to take part in their actions that were related against racism. They were ordered not to do that, and they obeyed the first time or two, but then they got a little bit uppity. Talk about that uncomfortable relationship that Phil Berrigan had with the church and why he still revered it.
The Catholic Church, Phil recognized, had this wonderful intellectual tradition, and the Catholic social teachings of the church are really wonderful. They're spot on. They're exactly what Phil believed in. The problem was they're not taught. They're not enacted, not to the degree that Phil felt that they should be. And so he was very critical of the church, very outspoken of the church. He would say the Catholic Church condemns all war in general, but no war in particular. Now, that's very true. It's easy to stand in a pulpit every Sunday and say, let us have peace. But unless you're calling out specific actions that are being done, it's a meaningless gesture. And Phil knew that. And so that was where he was trying to focus his energies on and bring the church around to a life force in this world, because he very much believed that we have a role in this world, in this lifetime, to do something to save those, to save our brothers and sisters across the globe. And in the Catholic Church, there is the idea of the mystical body of Christ, that we are all part of the mystical body of Christ. And so that if someone is harmed elsewhere, we're harmed and Christ is harmed. And certainly as Americans, living a very privileged and protective life, often at the expense of other vulnerable populations, we have a duty to step forward into the breach and to place ourselves and our bodies between those who would do the victims harm and the victims.
Again, folks, you're tuned in to Spirit in Action. This is a Northern Spirit Radio production. Our website, northernspiritradio.org. On that site, you find links to all of our guests for Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul for the past 18 and a half years. So you will find this book that was edited by our guest, Brad Wolf, called A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence. Phil Berrigan is the writer that we're raising up, remembering. And personally, I want to thank him even at this point, 22 years after his death. I want to thank him for all the difference he made in the world, even though as a Catholic, I was not aware of so much. I mean, I knew about Father Grappi in Milwaukee. I knew about some of these things. And the name Berrigan did come to my consciousness, but it wasn't taught from the pulpit where I was living. So I didn't hear that. So when I turned 18, I actually registered for the draft. Whereas I think even 1 year later, I would not have registered for the draft. I would have taken different tact. I turned 18 in 1972. They stopped drafting that year. So I actually never had to face anything about that personally. But at 18, I wasn't thinking that far ahead, just as I have a feeling that Phil was not thinking about it in the same way when he joined the military during World War II. What about you, Brad? I'm just curious about your transition. When did you become a peace activist? Have you ended up having to have encounters with the church and saying, you have to tell your priest, why aren't you talking about this?
I have. I'm still a member of the Catholic Church here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I'm certainly in the minority in my church. I occupy my little space of belief in the church, and I will not relinquish it because I believe the church has so much good to offer the world. It just needs to act on it and to talk about it. And so I do prompt my parish priest to be more active. I try to have things like a Blessed Are the Peacemakers speaking series at our church, which was difficult to get approved, but it did get approved. And two people showed up for these weekly meetings that I held out of, I think we have 1,500 parishioners at our church. So it's a challenge. And I grew up, as you mentioned, Catholic. I never heard of the Berrigans, even though I went to Catholic school. I never heard of Dorothy Day, never taught about Dorothy Day or the Berrigans or Thomas Merton. It wasn't until I was in my 40s that I knew about Dorothy Day and the Berrigans and Thomas Merton. And I saw, wow, these are Catholics who are walking the walk, because my understanding of Catholicism was just that it was a spiritual element. It didn't have any application in my day-to-day life, really. You know, it was something that I believed in a spiritual sense, but I'm not so sure it was dramatically changing my behavior. I went to law school because I believed in social justice and I wanted to work with the victims of violence. And, you know, I had that aspect, but it was not fueled by my religion. It was just fueled more by conscience at that point. It merged with theology and religion once I discovered the Berrigans. And then I saw, wow, this makes perfect sense. I understand it so much better now. And it deepened my faith and it deepened my activism in exponential ways.
Phil Berrigan, he was willing to take extreme consequences to be faithful to his faith, faithful to his faith. That shouldn't even have to be repeated there, but so often people have faith and they don't act faithfully to it, I guess. He served something over 11 years in jail and prison because of his actions. None of his actions actually hurt a single person, and yet 11 years in prison. I sensed in some of the writings that are included in A Ministry of Risk that there were times when he felt a bit down. He wasn't Little Miss Sunshine all of the time, but I didn't ever sense a wavering. Maybe some other people who knew him personally could see wavering. It's like, why am I doing this? I've got to be away from Elizabeth. I'm away from my children. That's something that's worth noting, too. At a certain point, he and Elizabeth declared that they were married. They didn't tell anyone else. It was just between them. And then eventually, they had a service recognition with a small group of people. But of course, since he was in religious orders, he wasn't supposed to get married. So one of the things that growing up myself, when I thought at all about going to religious orders, the fact that I wasn't going to be able to have a girlfriend was going to be a serious problem with that. Did you ever consider that direction yourself?
I did not. I was not called in that direction. And some of the friends I went to high school would probably really smirk at the thought of that, you know, of me doing that. But as you mentioned, Phil married Elizabeth McAllister. Now, Liz was a Catholic nun. Phil was a Catholic priest. Both are forbidden to marry. In 1969, they privately exchanged vows in a church, and they saw their love and their marriage as a radical assertion of their faith, as Phil wrote. Once it became public knowledge in 1970 that they were married, they were excommunicated from the church. So they continued to have an official marriage after that and raise a wonderful family and have this intentional living community called Jonah House in Baltimore. So they saw their vows of celibacy. They believe that celibacy should be optional in the Catholic Church, that priests and nuns should not be forbidden from touching another human being with affection if they're falling in love. And so they felt that that should be something that is optional. The church obviously does not agree with that. And so they were excommunicated, something that they were willing to live with. You know, again, these are part of the risks that Phil was willing to take. You mentioned the 11 years in prison. That's a tough one. For his first action at Baltimore in 1967, when he and three others go into the Selective Service Office and pour blood on draft files, symbolizing the spilt blood of Christ, as well as the spilt blood of Vietnamese and Americans who were dying in the war, he received a 6-year prison sentence for that. And before he could begin that prison sentence, he quickly organized the action in Catonsville, Maryland, because he knew he was going to go to prison, but he wanted to do another action that was even bigger and would stimulate more debate in America about the war. And so you'd think somebody facing a 6-year prison sentence would be on their best behavior. but not Phil, right? Not Phil. He goes out and organizes an even bigger action with 9 people going into a Selective Service office in Catonsville, Maryland. They take all these draft files out into the parking lot where they have notified the media, and they use homemade napalm to set them on fire. Again, a very symbolic action. You know, as Dan Berrigan wrote later, they were burning paper, not children. Yet they received another prison sentence on top of that. And then to top all that off, Phil, when he is to report for prison after those 2 actions, he and Dan decide to continue their resistance by not reporting for prison, becoming fugitives from justice, and going underground. And they did that not because they wanted to escape prison or felt they were never going to go to prison. They knew they were going to be captured, but they wanted to show the risk that you need to take to continue resistance to the war. And so they're on the run from J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI for quite a while. So these were enormous risks. And Phil did, once he was incarcerated, have bouts of depression and, as he refers to it, the doldrums. Very honest in his writings about, oh, I was engaged in a lot of self-pity this week. I've got to get myself out of it. Prison life is hard. It wears down the humanity of everyone there. And he was sort of an astute observer of how his own humanity was being ground down by prison life. And he would have to find ways to pick himself up and work with the inmates to pick them up.
His theology, I think, evolved during the times that he was facing this. One of the things that struck me is in his later writings, he ends up referring to God as she a number of times, and I was very pleased to see that evolution going around. I have a feeling he was not reading the King James Version of the Bible at that point. Matter of fact, I think I saw some comment in his writings about, at least it wasn't King James Version. Where did he evolve to religiously, spiritually, in terms of the Bible? Because I found it problematic dealing with the Bible, because I read in the early books, the 5 books of Moses, that God's telling people to go in and kill every woman, child, goat. You're supposed to go into promised land and kill people. So that's God telling you to do that. And obviously, the God that is manifested through Jesus gives a very different message about loving your enemy and turning the other cheek and so on. So what happened with him in terms of his theology there? I'm not completely clear about it, having read the full text of A Ministry of Risk.
Well, if you start from Phil's childhood, you get an understanding of what perspective he might have always had about the Bible. So he's born in 1923, very poor, one of 6 boys, to a very poor family in Minnesota. His father is a socialist. His mother is Catholic and gets the Catholic Worker newspaper and reads the Catholic Worker newspaper to her children every week. They're schooled in this tradition of Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker and of enacting the works of mercy on a daily basis, right? You house the homeless, you feed the hungry, you care for the sick, you visit the prisoners. And so even though they were desperately poor during the Depression, Phil would write about how people would knock on their door who were starving, and his mother would invite them in and sit them down for dinner and share these meals that were already quite small, share them, cut them again, and dividing them up again so everybody would have something. So Phil comes at the Bible, and he particularly the Gospels, from that perspective, from this very sort of humanitarian perspective. Though his early writings are not nearly as expansive on the gospel as his later writings, for instance, referring to God as a she and understanding this kind of concept, they still have this very humanistic perspective to them that we are to take action in this world now. Part of that was influenced by Dan, because Dan had spent some time in France working with the worker priests, who were priests in the 1940s and 50s in France, who had been asked to work out with the laborers and help them organize. And it was a short-lived movement. The church shut it down very quickly because they were helping to unionize workers. But it was very important to Dan and to Phil because it put them right in the position of people leading day-to-day lives and how a priest is to be important in that day-to-day life. So when Phil would write about the Bible and he would look at, you know, Exodus and Leviticus and, you know, some of these very violent sections of the Bible, he would see it in a really broad scope of an evolution of humanity, of moving from violence to the peaceful gospels of Christ.
My first wife, her practice was to read regularly through the Gospels. Less frequently would she go through the other books of New Testament and the rest of the Bible. So it seems to me that she was doing the practice that was very native to what Phil Berrigan was doing. The Gospel was the centerpiece that bared a lot of repeating, scrutiny, study, depth. And the rest of it, it's not that he doesn't quote from Micah and others. He very much does bring those in, but it's very clear that the gospel is where things sit for him.
And I would say the prophets as well. He's very much quoting the prophets and then from the Psalms, but certainly the four gospels are critical.
And certainly he wanted us to have a prophetic voice, that we were called to be prophets, or at least some of us are. One of the things I found interesting about his use of the she, I've debated that. I understand that in the original form, the Gospels, Jesus is usually saying, Daddy, you know, Abba. He's using words in that direction. So you don't find a lot of she, although there can be overtones of that. The one that I found was most interesting was the words that gets translated as loving kindness is actually from the root word in Hebrew for womb. It's a womb love. God loves us with a womb love. And then God's mother there, God's she.
Maternal.
Do you get any of that from the pulpit in your church?
None. No. Unfortunately, not here in central Pennsylvania. We do not. I know that there are Catholic churches that are doing that, but mine is a conservative church where they are trying desperately to integrate aspects of the Latin Mass. I find the Latin Mass to be beautiful in and of itself, but I don't like it being used as a political tool.
What's your religious spiritual search been like?
I go to the daily Mass at my church at 12 o'clock. Typically, it's a 35-minute Mass without any music and very few people. It provides me an opportunity to be very reflective and meditative without the interruption of drums and guitar and singing and sort of a social situation that occurs on Sundays that I'm not particularly fond of. So I really enjoy that part of it. It's very much an alone time for me to be with Christ and to reflect on what my faith means to me and how I am to enact it. That's important. I spent about 7 years as a Buddhist practitioner. I left the Catholic Church and I was really very much a devout Buddhist practitioner, and I enjoyed it very much and learned a tremendous amount from it. And it actually ended up deepening my Catholic faith. I stopped being a Buddhist practitioner because I missed the personal relationship with God that Christianity brought to me and that I did not find in Buddhism. But many of the teachings of Buddhism I found also to occur in Christianity, and I was able to see them in a far deeper way. Certainly the loving kindness aspect of Buddhism that's so important is there in Christianity. It's just covered with different words that we misunderstand, but we are to be compassionate, loving, kind, caring individuals all of the time. And there is no doubt that we are to be nonviolent. This idea that Christians can be violent and engage in war is a facade. Jesus was the ultimate nonviolent resister.
We should talk a little bit about the history of the Catholic Church regard to war, because my understanding is that for the first 300 years, to be Christian was to be pacifist, was to resist violence. You couldn't join a Christian church and be part of the military. So that changed when the state and the religion went together in the 300s. Before that, though, Christians were the pacifists.
They were. And this alliance between church and state that occurred with Constantine is really troublesome, because at that point, then they had to abandon the central teaching of nonviolence and adopt this just war theory, which was just sort of an intellectual creation, not a spiritual creation, but something that Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine had developed as a convenience to create an alliance, a marriage with the state. They gained protection from the state. They gained riches and power from the state. They began to be corrupted by the state and by the culture of militarism that's with any powerful state. And ever since then, Catholics and Christians have been fighting this just war concept and saying, we thought Christ was nonviolent, and yet you're telling us it's okay to go to war. Catholic priests in America have blessed battleships. They're constantly visiting the troops and telling them they're fighting the good fight, which is absurd. It's absolutely absurd, entirely inconsistent with the gospel and what Jesus taught.
And folks, you're going to read about a lot of how the church and how someone who's sincere in his deep Catholic faith, Phil Berrigan, dealt with this in his life of activism in the book A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, Philip Berrigan, that was edited by my guest, Brad Wolf. You can get a hold of Brad perhaps best through the merchantsofdeath.org website. You can find out about the book at philipberrigan.com. Both of those links will be on northernspiritradio.org, just like all of the other folks from the past 18 and a half years. I've got links to them, and they're worth checking out. There's so many ways people doing world healing work, and we're trying to raise that up as part of our work here. So please, when you visit NordenspiritRadio.org, post a comment on this show, on the other shows you listen to. You can donate to support us. We don't take money from corporations, and that's very important for us, because as soon as you do, as Brad was just mentioning, when you're in relationship, financial relationship, your livelihood relationship with something, you tend to trade off against your ideals. And so we ask that you, our listeners, support us. And also please support the 35-plus community radio stations across the country that carry our programs. They are working on a shoestring, and you can throw in a few shoestrings and make things hold together much better. So please support them as well. Brad Wolf, again, I have the links on NordenspiritRadio.org. There's so much we can talk about of the writings of Philip Berrigan, but I do want to talk a little bit more about this relationship church and how Phil and also his brother Dan had to deal with the fact that they weren't doing obedience to the church. They were, in some point of view, as people might say, they were no longer selling out to the commercial system around them. And so they became disobedient and were excommunicated, went to prison. But one of the things that Phil did that I think was absolutely essential is founding of the Jonah community. And by the way, here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where I live, there is an interfaith group called Jonah, Joining Our Neighbors, Advancing Hope, inspired by that same thing. We work together for the good of all the people here, with many different faiths represented. Tell us a little bit about Jonah House. Certainly, Phil and Liz were centerpieces to that house, but there were a whole number of people transformed, enriched. It wasn't a Catholic worker house, though, was it?
It was not, but it was like a Catholic worker house in that it was an intentional living community. It was in Baltimore. They formed it in 1973, and they wanted to have a place where they would live and raise a family, do so in faith and in resistance and resisting the empire. And that meant resisting materialism. It meant embracing ways of life of voluntary poverty, you know, intentionally living below the income level such that they would have to contribute any taxes to the war machine. And so here is Philip Berrigan, a Catholic priest with a college degree and a master's degree and the author of 9 books and on the cover of Time magazine. But his job from 1973 up until he died was to paint houses, to earn enough money just to pay the bills. And, you know, they would gather food that was being thrown out from grocery stores and deliver to all the neighbors and to people in Jonah House. Jonah House consisted of Phil and Liz and eventually their 3 children. But a number of other people, a dozen or more of other people who would live there and learn and work with Phil and Liz. They would study the gospel every day. They would have ecumenical services each day. They would plan nonviolent resistant efforts continually. So throughout the 70s, Phil was always at the Pentagon, staging actions, pouring his blood on the pillars of the Pentagon and getting arrested for that. He was working with others to dig a symbolic grave on the White House lawn, saying, "Disarm or dig graves." And then, of course, he comes up with the Plowshares movement in 1980, which was to go into weapons plants and symbolically hammer on the nose cones of missiles to beat swords into plowshares. All of that planning was done at the Jonah House, and the Jonah House became this wonderful training ground of Catholic peace activists. And then not just Catholic peace activists, but peace activists of all faiths started going there, living there, experiencing life in that kind of community. And I have talked to and interviewed so many people who were there who said it was a life-changing experience. Literally, their life was going in one direction. After being there for a while and working with Phil and Liz and others, it went in an entirely other direction. So it was a very important gathering place, a very important educational, faith-based, nonviolent resistance working house.
One of the phrases that I think I saw repeated times in the collection of Phil's writings was that he was Catholic trying to become Christian, or tried to be Christian. What does that mean to you?
I think that sort of embodies Phil's entire criticism of the Catholic Church, that we can call ourselves Catholic, but unless we are truly Christian in a Christ-like way, it's meaningless. And that is a lifelong task because you're constantly trying to be a Christian. You're trying to enact the works of mercy, but you're never fully getting there. It's something, it's a journey, and it's something you do forever. And so, as you say, Phil was a Catholic trying to be a Christian. He's an ordained Catholic priest. He's well versed on the dogma of the church. He can do mass. He can quote everything you need to quote. But can he live it out? Can he live out the life of Christ as Phil Berrigan? And that's the question. And that's the challenge. And that's the thing that he was convicted by. And it's something that readers, I think, will be challenged and hopefully convicted by if they read the book. One of the things that I did when researching the book is I'd go through the archives. I'd photograph with my iPhone hundreds of pages of Phil's writings because it's the first book I ever researched. So it was the only way I knew how to do it was just to photograph all of these documents. And I would come home from Cornell and DePaul with hundreds and hundreds of photographs of Phil's writings. And then I would dictate them aloud into my computer so I could start the editing process. And saying Phil's words aloud had an impact on me that I had not anticipated, because when you say somebody's words aloud, you have a bit of ownership in those words that you don't have when you're just reading them silently. And so often I would stop after saying something Phil had written, and I would check myself and say, wow, am I up to that? You know, that really challenges me. Could I do that? Do I believe that? Could I enact it in that way that Phil did? That was really important. And there is no doubt that the research and writing of this book changed my life. And I think if readers buy this book, and just as an example, read some of the passages out loud and see if it's not different for them than reading them silently, and see if it doesn't challenge them and convict them in a different way.
Another one of the interesting things about Phil Berrigan is that he did, some people may not know this, Catholics have seven sacraments. You know, you get your baptism, your first communion, your confirmation, confession, all of these things you've got. But some of the less practiced ones, last rites is the last of the seven. But you can either be married, marriage is one of the sacraments, or you get to take holy orders, become a priest or nun, but you don't get to do both of those. But he got all seven in, and I think that makes him holier than the rest of us, doesn't it?
He did get them all in. That's quite rare. That's quite unusual. And of course, Elizabeth did as well. So he was able to get all of those in, and Frieda talks about that in the preface of the book. You know, Phil was indeed a very holy man. He was a very practical man. He believed in action. He believed in organizing. He believed in carrying out activities. But he was a very deeply holy and prophetic man, to the degree that Frieda told me that he so believed in his faith that when he was dying of cancer in 2002, he asked his brother Dan to give him the last rites. And Dan did. And when Phil didn't pass away immediately after that, he said from the bed to Elizabeth, "Why haven't I died? Dan gave me the last rites." And Elizabeth said, "Well, Phil, you're not ready yet. That's not the way it works." And he said, "But no, Dan gave me the last rites." That was the level of his belief. Really amazing stories like that that give you insight into the individual.
When we follow the full span of Phil Berrigan's life, his activism originally starts around civil rights. It becomes part of objection to the war in Vietnam and then war in general, and then becomes the plowshares actions. And mind you, in the early 80s, I was so moved by this. There's a song that I'll share at the end here by Charlie King, "The Hammer Has to Fall," about Dean Hammer and the others who were all part of that plowshares action. Then plowshares for 20 plus years becomes the central part of his activism, his witness in the world. Talk a little bit, if you would, Brad, about the plowshares actions, how many there were. It wasn't just Phil and Dan and others that were participating in these. There's a whole host of people who became inspired and worked to try and rid this world of the threat of nuclear Armageddon.
They did. The plowshares actions continue to this day. There have been over 70 plowshares actions all across the globe. Just like the draft card destruction actions that Phil did in the 60s, that spurred other people to do that as well. And so selective service offices all across the country in the late 1960s were being hit by activists who ended up destroying tens of thousands of draft files. And of course, there were no copies of the draft files kept then. So that meant those young men could not be conscripted into the military to kill or be killed. And with the Plowshares actions, when Phil did the first one in 1980, September of 1980 at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, at the General Electric Nuclear Facility, that started a whole series of Plowshares actions where other people started doing the same thing. And Phil was involved in many of them himself. Liz was involved in some. John Deere was involved in some. But many of them were without him. And it's a very organic movement. And I think peace movements have to be organic. Resistance movements have to be that way. You have to empower other people to sort of take up the banner and make it their own. So these things have happened in Germany at the military bases there. They've happened in Ireland. They've happened in England, all over the place. The focus for Phil was nuclear weapons at General Electric and King of Prussia. He was particularly concerned about the morality of nuclear weapons. He felt that we built our intentions into those weapons in terms of how we treat our fellow brother and sister across the globe by building these weapons that we know are going to incinerate hundreds of millions of innocent people. And what does that say about us? What does that mean in terms of our loss of morality, our loss of humanity, our loss of spirituality? It was very concerning to him. And so he fought that fight all the way to the end until his very last entry on his deathbed is about the scourge of nuclear weapons. And so again, he launches this Plowshares effort that, thank goodness, continues to this day with people continuing to engage in it. You know, Martha Hennessy, who's Dorothy Day's granddaughter, was a participant in it. It goes on. So Phil's work lives on. The nonviolent resistance efforts live on in different forms.
Does Jonah House live on?
It does. I was just down there in October, and there was a new community there, an African-American community that lives there and continues the good work. They're down in Baltimore. You can Google them and find out more about them, but it's a wonderful community house there.
There are also many wonderful seeds that he planted that he helped nurture. They're still bearing fruit today, including through the book, A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence. There was at least one case where he was found not guilty or it was hung. And so I'm sure he was holding to maybe the hope that the juries are going to come along, that that's where the people's court could be manifested. But somehow the system prevented that.
It did. And the court that you're referring to was the Harrisburg trial, the famous trumped up charges about kidnapping Henry Kissinger and blowing up tunnels in Washington. And J. Edgar Hoover felt that if he could just put forward really explosive charges, whether they're true or not, in front of the most conservative jury in Pennsylvania he could find, which was Harrisburg, Pennsylvania at the time, he thought for sure a jury would convict. And this is in 1972. And the fact is, they did not. They were a hung jury. They could not come to an agreement as to the charges because the evidence was just not there. And so the prosecution had to withdraw those charges. Phil was looking at life imprisonment if he were convicted on that. There were 23 charges lodged against he and six others for that in Harrisburg. And J. Edgar Hoover desperately wanted to put Philip and Daniel away for the rest of their lives. That was a serious time, but those charges were withdrawn and Phil was eventually released at the end of 1972.
Let's bring this back, Brad, to you. Again, Brad Wolf, you edited and you have an introduction in this book, and you've put a fair amount of your life into bringing about A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence. You are co-founder of the Peace Action Network of Lancaster County there in Pennsylvania. What do you do? Do you go to jail? Do you get arrested?
I was just arrested last week, Good Friday. I risk arrest when I can. We went down to King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, the very same spot where Phil and the Plowshares action began. It's now owned by Lockheed Martin. We go there every Good Friday, every Martin Luther King Day, and every year on the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And we have a nonviolent action there. This last Good Friday, we went. It was a much larger action because of Gaza. We were all committed to risking arrest by going onto the property, taking just a few steps onto the private property of Lockheed Martin and peacefully resisting the building of bombs and the killing of innocents. And so 25 of us were arrested on Good Friday, and we were taken to the Marion County Police Station and charged. I pled not guilty and asked to have a hearing. That hearing hasn't been scheduled yet, but I look forward to it. And a group of us were arrested in Washington, D.C. in November of 2023, this last November, when we went back to Raytheon Technologies as part of the War Crimes Tribunal. We were on the public sidewalk that Raytheon had purchased and said that we could not be on. And we refused to leave very respectfully, very peacefully, and said, when they stop making bombs, we will leave. But until then, we read the list of the names of the dead children who had been killed in the Saudi school bus attack by the Saudis and a Raytheon weapon. And so we were all arrested there. And an interesting turn in that is that they charged us with a first degree misdemeanor there, a fairly serious offense, up to a year in prison. And when it came time for our trial date just this past January, the prosecutor was very nice. He was a young African American gentleman, and he said to us, several decades ago, people did what you were doing for civil rights. And if they had not, I wouldn't be where I am today. So I'm going to withdraw the charges against you. And so all the charges against us were withdrawn in that incident, which was a very moving and powerful thing to hear how something decades ago, those good, peaceful, nonviolent efforts of decades ago come back and circle back to today. I can't claim to do anything like Phil Berrigan does in terms of spending 11 years in prison. I'm not called to that kind of prison witness, but we all have a part to play. And I entitled the book A Ministry of Risk because I believe that we all have a ministry of risk to undertake, and it looks different for each one of us. Some of us may speak, we may write, we may act, we may do whatever, but we all have a ministry of risk to discover, to embrace, and to fulfill.
I'm thankful to Phil Berrigan for raising that up for us, changing your life, changing my life, and change lives of so many others as we move forward to make this a more blessed earth that we live upon, a more blessed place where we actually call everyone, not just our friends, but our enemies, we call them family and care about their well-being. Thank you so much, Brad, for collecting these writings, for living faithfully there in Lancaster. And remember again, folks, we have links for philberrigan.com, where you can find out about the book, merchantsofdeath.org, and on Facebook, PAN, that's the Peace Action Network of Lancaster. Those links are on nordenspiritradio.org. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really enjoyed our conversation.
As promised, I'm closing with a song about the Plowshares 8 action that both Philip and Daniel Berrigan were part of. The song is by the wonderful Charlie King, and it's called The Hammer Has to Fall. Follow the links on nordenspiritradio.org, and we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The Hammer Has to Fall.
My name is Daniel Berrigan, chaplain at a hospice for the dying. I have seen the face of death, it is for life, I bring this hammer down. My name is Molly Rush, I have six children, they deserve a future. I strike this blow today for the children, all the world around. I hear the prophet's cry of hope ring through the prison wall. We've waited 30 centuries to see that hammer fall. If we think we've got 30 more, we cannot see at all. For swords into plowshares, the hammer has to fall. My name is Elmer Moss. Were this a peaceful world, I'd sit and play piano. But lacking Nero's conscience, I could not watch that fire devour the land. My name is John Shouchard. I am no stranger to the prison that awaits us. But where genocide is legal, I stand an outlaw with a hammer in my hand. I hear the prophet's cry of hope ring through the prison wall. We've waited 30 centuries to see that hammer fall. If we think we've got 30 more, we cannot see at all. For swords into plowshares, hammer has to fall. Dean Hammer is my name.
Micah and Isaiah, my tradition. Oh, I tried to be their scholar, but could not escape their logic in the end. My name is Philip Berrigan. In World War II, I flew the bombing missions. Now with every blow I strike today, I say the bombs will never fall again. I hear the prophet's cry of hope ring through the prison wall. We've waited 30 centuries to see that hammer fall. If we think we've got 30 more, we cannot see at all. For swords into plowshares, the hammer has to fall.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song,